This is Radio Times. I'm Artie Moss-Cohen. When Lydia Denworth's son Alex was a baby, she sensed that something was wrong. He did not react when she read him bedtime stories like her other children had and seemed unaware of the sounds around him. He was diagnosed with moderate to profound hearing loss and fitted with hearing aids. But soon she and her husband realized the extent of his deafness and decided, after some soul-searching, to get a cochlear implant for Alex. Lydia Denworth, who is a science writer, writes about this in her new book, I Can Hear You Whisper. It's also about the pros and cons and controversies about implants, the latest brain research on sound and language development, and what it's been like to raise a child with a hearing loss. And Lydia Denworth, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Thank you for having me.
You're welcome. Let's go back to those early days when Alex was an infant. You describe at the very beginning of your book, reading Goodnight Moon, as many parents have read to their children, and realizing that how he was reacting to the story was not like how your other children had.
That's right. Like so many parents, I interacted with him when I was reading, and I would say things like, can you point to the cow jumping over the moon? And he just never could point to the cow, and I became a little obsessed with the cow and thinking, why is he not doing this? Shouldn't he be doing this by now? But, you know, you second-guess yourself a little bit, and every kid is different. But as it went on over time, I really started to get worried.
Well, and what's also interesting, I mean, you learned that he had moderate to profound hearing loss, but it also seemed to show up to some degree in his sort of motor and physical development as well early on.
Yeah, our situation was a little different, fortunately, I think, for most people, because it took longer than it should have for us to figure out what was going on. And that's because Alex, it is now mandatory in most states for babies to be screened at birth for hearing, which is a wonderful thing, and it has changed the field enormously. Alex had that screening at birth. He failed it, but then he passed one a few weeks later. So we kind of put hearing out of our mind. And then he was slow to hit a lot of milestones as an infant. And every time we would worry, you know, your worry goes to a simmer to a boil, he would then do the next thing. And so we would say, okay, I guess he's all right. But those things, it turned out later when we figured out what was going on with him that he has a congenital deformity of the inner ear and the vestibular system, so balance was affected for him too. That can be a case for some kids. It's not for everyone, but it clearly was what was going on with him.
So the diagnosis for his hearing loss?
So the diagnosis for his hearing, actually we first found out that he had this moderate to profound loss in both ears, and then later we had a medical workup and he had a CAT scan, and normally it can be very hard to figure out what the cause of hearing loss is, and you don't necessarily know if you ever will. So we were sort of surprised that we got this very clear answer, which was that in fact he had this deformity of the inner ear, and he has an additional condition called enlarged vestibular aqueduct, where if he gets hit in the head or suffers a major change in pressure even, he can lose what hearing remains. So, and those two things can often go together, which is why he probably never had good hearing, and he shouldn't have passed that screening at the beginning, but, you know, that's another story, probably.
So was it a relief to get the diagnosis, or did it open up a whole other list of worries for you?
Actually, you're right. It was a relief in many ways because it was an answer, and because for us, we had been having quite a long time of wondering what was going on here. I describe it as like falling downstairs in slow motion. It was just long and agonizing, and it kept getting worse, and we didn't know what was going on. And the not knowing, I think, is much harder than knowing. That said, of course, it was upsetting. It's more than 90% of deaf and hard of hearing children are born to hearing parents like me, who mostly, this was the first deaf or hard of hearing child I ever met was my own.
You'd never met a deaf person before.
I'd met deaf people in some way, but when I tried to think about, did I have relationships with deaf kids? I didn't. And I don't think that's all that unusual, actually. And so that meant that you know, this was really a whole unknown world. And that was the scariest, hardest part, was just trying to figure out how I was going to learn about
Well, you
this.
Are a science writer, so you put those skills to work to educate yourself.
I did. Research is my coping mechanism, most clearly.
Knowledge is power.
You know, I went to work. I didn't know at the beginning that my joke now is that I've been writing this book since Alex was born, but I didn't know it for a while. You know, I did what parents do. You start looking things up.
Well, what's interesting is that for a time he did have some hearing aids. I mean, some
he did.
You
so,
used those.
In fact, what happened is that his hearing got worse. I mentioned earlier that he has this condition where it can be progressive. So he started when we first were identified, it was moderate to profound, but it quickly became entirely profound in one ear, and it looked like it was going that was going to happen in the other. We were just waiting for the second shoe to drop, and he was still not really developing his language. His language was quite delayed at the time. So that's when he became a candidate for a cochlear implant. Yeah. And that's, again, where, you know, when we had the hearing aids, we thought we were sort of done. We thought we knew where we were, what we were dealing with, and, okay, we can do this. He'll get extra speech therapy, but he's got enough hearing. He should be able to develop spoken language. And then suddenly it got worse again.
There's a scene where he throws his hearing aids into a street.
Yes, I think anyone who's had a two-year-old boy,
or he's just being a two-year-old.
I think probably more a two-year-old boy. I mean, it's hard to know, and any parent with a kid with hearing aids or implants will tell you that, especially when they're little, it's very, very hard to keep the things on their heads.
Sure,
and
sure.
At the beginning, but the irony is now I can't get him to take it off.
Well, what's interesting is not only did you talk about making the decision to have a cochlear implant for your son, you also talk about the history of these implants. And for maybe until even recently, they were kind of considered really sort of a wacky thing to do.
They were – when people first had the idea actually dates back hundreds of years of using electricity. And maybe I should say that a hearing aid amplifies sound and it uses your residual hearing, but a cochlear implant is artificial hearing.
That's
it's
right.
Electrical hearing, and it bypasses your ear. It's like flying direct. You know, if the cochlea is the hub of hearing, you're delivering sound directly to the auditory nerve and taking it up to the brain. So it's an amazing idea. And people had the idea of using electricity hundreds of years ago, but then it took a long time to figure out what they might do. And then in the 60s, here in the U.S., we had some people, a surgeon in particular in California, Bill House, who had the idea that he really wanted to pursue this and he thought he could do it. And first, the controversy was in the scientific world. Everyone thought he was completely nuts and that there was no way this could work. And the more you knew about how the inner ear worked, the less you thought this was likely to work. Yeah. The auditory neurophysiologists of the time were uniformly, especially the establishment ones. That's one of the interesting parts is that it was all the people in California who were
saying,
No, the people in California were the ones saying, yes, we think we can make this work. And people on the East Coast establishment, at least that's what the people in California like to say.
I've seen that pattern
before. Have you heard
that
before?
Yes,
right.
So anyway,
I don't know. I'm agnostic on that, but that's what they say. And it is true. There were a lot of people on the West Coast. But first you had a scientific controversy. And then when people started to think that maybe this could work, then you had a cultural controversy, which came later. And
right.
So that was when people in deaf culture reacted unhappily.
And I do want to get to all of that. But you know, this is even for parents who thought this was a good idea, this is a big step for you to take.
It's a big step. It's, you know, I have to say they kind of had me at hello. It seemed like a really terrific piece of technology, and the benefits, the potential benefits for my son seemed pretty extraordinary. It's scary, though, to subject a child to surgery. There's
sure.
no question.
And he was pretty little at the
time.
He
was two. He was about 4 months shy of his third birthday, and which was important because of the window for language acquisition. But he... in my family, medicine has been a force for good always, historically. And so I suppose I came into it with less anxiety than others might. And I know some people worry more. What was harder for me was reconciling my view of this technology with, as I said, the view of some other people. But we'll get to that. But it's big. And it's, you know, the night of before the surgery, looking at his ear and thinking there's always going to be something in there now.
Yes.
And I mean, you know, that's your precious baby. That's not an easy thing.
Do you know what he hears now with his implant? What words or even the world sounds like to him?
Well, I can tell you that in a sound booth where he's tested all the time as a regular thing, he does very well. He hears, he can hear. He has actually scored 100% on some tests of word recognition and not every time and not, you know, and that's quite unusual. It's at least in the 80 to 90%. But the real world is not like a sound booth.
No, exactly. In fact, there's a lot of extraneous noise.
There's a lot of extraneous noise. And he does not, I feel sure that you know, he is not getting 90% of what is said in the real world, but he gets enough. What cochlear implants do is they take you from being deaf to being hard of hearing. They don't make you hearing. You're not hearing the world like a hearing person does. In fact, and I get into this in the book, the signal, as some of the engineers who invented it say, it's pretty crappy, really. It makes the world sound a bit like Donald Duck, I'm told, or like somebody delivering a ransom note.
Meaning kind of threatening?
No, meaning like that, that, you know, on
that kind of tense.
That
kind, oh.
No, that artificial, when somebody uses a voice disguise,
yes.
Disguiser or whatever the word is for that. That is how adults who've lost their hearing later in life and then get a cochlear implant describe it. My son, the irony in this is that I have done years of research and there is a huge amount that I know, but what I can never know is how the world actually really sounds to my own son. And he can't really even tell me because, of course, he only knows what he knows and he doesn't know what the world sounds like to me either.
But what's interesting is you saw, seems like rather quickly, that he began to develop language.
He did. And so in our case, they spend a lot of time trying to damp down your expectations, and it often can take quite a lot of time. It's important for people to recognize that this technology is not a magic bullet. That's when the work starts once you've had the surgery. You have to do a lot of practice listening and rehabilitation, which is part of why the brain is such an important part of the story. But in Alex's case, he literally the next day after it was turned on, he started to say words that had high frequency energy in them, like cook, cake. And he, with hearing aids, had never said the word cake or a kuh sound in his life. If he wanted to tell our friend Tom, you know, to come, he'd say instead of come Tom because he couldn't say kuh or tuh. He couldn't hear it. With an implant, the next day, he said kuh. And we all, even my four-year-old, his older, next older brother, recognized that something significant had happened.
And the whole family go, wow!
Yeah, wow! He said cake! It's amazing what you celebrate, right?
Now he's, what, 11 now?
He just turned 11 in April. Yeah, he's in fifth grade.
And how's his language today?
It's great. If you meet him, you would not think that he's deaf. So he gets support in school. He gets extra, He's doing very well, actually. He's getting A's, if I may say. Well done. But we do have a teacher of the deaf that spends a few hours a week in and out of the classroom with him. He gets some extra tutoring on the outside, and I think that he will benefit from getting that as long as I can get him to take it. Middle school and
exactly.
Preteen years
is
so different.
Yeah.
You know, it's a little different from what I could control when he was younger. But he made truly stupendous progress in the first year with his cochlear implant. He went from the bottom of the language charts to the top. That's a little unusual, but it does show you what's possible.
I want to pick up on that after this very short break. That's Lydia Denworth, our guest in this hour of Radio Times. She's a new book. It's called I Can Hear You Whisper, and it's subtitled An Intimate Journey Through the Science of Sound and Language. It's also about her son, Alex, who now has a cochlear implant, and while he is still deaf, he can hear the world. We're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.com. And you can send us a tweet at Marty Moss Cohen. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Cancer Treatment Centers of America in Philadelphia supports WHYY. CTCA now offers genomic testing to help doctors determine treatment options based on patients' personal genetic makeup. Genomic tumor assessment may hold the key to help patients improve quality of life and discover more precise treatment options that were previously not considered. More at cancercenter.com. Cancer Treatment Centers of America. Care that never quits.
The Executive Doctorate of Business Administration at Temple University's Fox School of Business supports WHYY. This 3-year applied research-focused degree is designed to provide experienced business leaders the skills to address tomorrow's challenges. Executive DBA students receive faculty mentorship, online collaboration, and the Fox School's reputation for high-quality research. Temple University Fox School of Business. Discover the power of Fox. Learn more at fox.temple.edu/executive DBA.
Supporting WHYY, the Philadelphia Museum of Art, presenting Treasures from Korea, Arts and Culture of the Joseon Dynasty, the first full-scale American exhibition devoted to the art of the Joseon Dynasty. 500 years of tradition, ritual, and honor from a line of 27 kings that shaped contemporary Korea. The exhibition brings many Korean national treasures to the U.S. for the first time. On view through May 26th. Tickets and info at philamuseum.org.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoane. Our guest Lydia Denworth used her science writing skills to help her understand her son Alex, who was diagnosed with profound hearing loss when he was a toddler. He's now 11. He has a cochlear implant, and she writes about all of this in her new book called I Can Hear You Whisper. And we have calls coming in at 1-888-477-9499. I get the feeling that in your house there's a lot of talking. It's a sort of language-rich environment. Yes?
Yes, indeed it is. Not only am I a professional talker and
talker
writer,
person, yes.
I'm a word person, always have been. I have three boys. Alex is the youngest, and the other two are 15 and 12, Jake and Matthew. And I really do think that having that interplay, that language going on with the siblings helped Alex enormously. It's one of the things that helped him to make such a big leap. And they just always talked to him. They never stopped talking to him.
Even if he could hear them or not?
No, the day we came home, there's a scene in the book, the day that we came home and said we finally figured out what's going on with Alex and why he's not talking. And we said it's because we think he can't actually hear us very well. And they both got down on either side of him and they yelled in his ears, "We love you, Alex!" And Alex grinned because he was the center of attention, and the other two figured they'd been given license to yell
right.
in the house, right? And they have ever since. I mean, I think the soundtrack of a house with three boys is just louder than most other people's.
Well, I was telling you this before we went on the air, and I want to repeat it, actually, because we've done a number of programs on Radio Times about language acquisition mm-hmm. and how some children just don't have households where there's a lot of talking, a lot of interacting going on, and they often come to school with a kind of deficit. They just don't have the language skills to be able to put them to work in first and second grade and all the grades that follow up. Your story is sort of a parallel story, but an interesting and slightly different one in that this is a very language-rich environment.
Right. So for us, for Alex, it was critical then that he be bathed in sound even more than any other kid. Although I think one of my big takeaways and one of the reasons I felt that there was a book in this, I mean, my own story, as compelling as I think it is not necessarily by itself a complete book. But when I started to understand the science of the brain and the importance of sound, which it's so easy to take for granted if you don't have it yanked away from you. And even I'd already raised two other boys or was in the process who were talking and starting to read and all of that. And of course we know sound affects spoken language, but then to make the leap to reading
yes.
was not something that was intuitive for me. In fact, I think I would have assumed that you would read more if you were deaf. And the fact that could be a real struggle was worrying, but also so important. And then I thought so important for all children, for hearing children, for kids from all different backgrounds. And the critical research that was done in the 90s by Hart and Risley, which I talk about in the book and maybe people are familiar with, which is that 30 million word gap where kids, before they ever walk in the door of school, you know, some kids were hearing more than 40 million words and other kids were hearing 10 million words in their whole lifetime. And that so right at the starting gate of school, you're behind and you won't catch up. But what I found really stunning in addition to that and beyond that, so now what people are doing is looking at what is going on in the brain and the difference for the kids who have heard all the words versus the kids who haven't. And your processing time is different, your reaction time to what you hear. And the faster you can react, the faster you can take in what comes next. And so what they know is that the speed with which your brain processes sound the day you enter kindergarten correlates directly with how fast you'll read when you're in fourth grade.
Wow. And we're obviously talking about this – extraordinary organ, the brain,
yes,
the plasticity of the brain. And even as you sort of deconstruct what the brain is doing, it is such a marvel. I mean, to think about to think about sound and how sound becomes language, and language obviously becomes communication and
that
contact.
That's exactly what I got so fascinated. I wrote a whole book. Because that's what I really started to say. You know, sound, for hearing people, sound is the gateway to language, but language is communication, is literacy, is all of these other things. And I just hadn't really made that connection. And even with Alex, when I started out, I thought I was just needed to know everything there was to know about ears. You know, I was fixated on that part of his body and that part of his anatomy. And then I began to see, no, wait, I'm going further. I'm getting deeper into this brain. And a brain is mysterious, and you can never see it the way you're going to see the ear on the outside, right? You can't see this cascade of responses that's happening in there. But it's critical that all parents of all kids are thinking about that all the time.
You're right. Even more than his hearing, Alex's brain was mysterious. It required faith. I couldn't touch it or caress it as I did his ears, running my fingers along their small curving lobes. Of course, I knew his brain was there. But the idea is, I mean, it is this mystery, but also knowing that he couldn't hear on top of that.
Right. And so what happens is every experience that a baby has, and we know this on some level, some it's kind of obvious, but it's also profound, and so every sound that a baby hears from in utero forward is etched into the networks of their brain that are either formed or not formed, and those networks, now they understand language differently. You know, for so many years, more than 100 years, people kind of thought of it as sound production or sound perception, and those two blocks, and only recently have neuroscientists, and I got to talk to the guys who are at the forefront of this, have they started to reconsider how language works in the brain. And they think that language works in the brain the way it does in English class, that it's organized around grammar and sound and meaning, and it's networks. It's all about circuits and networks, and it's not just, you know, one thing here or one thing there. And all of those networks are laid down all through the first year of life, and it's like a silent rehearsal before babies are talking. Mm. They're taking all this in. And so now I really want to, it's important to say that a deaf child who's raised signing, as long as they're getting enough ASL early on, it actually lays down
American
Sign Language, right. It lays down in the very same sets of networks in the brain where spoken language does in kids who are oral. So that is neurobiological proof that this is absolutely its own language, and that wonderful things are possible. The problem is that not enough kids can get enough ASL, enough sign language, early enough, and they have to be getting it right from the start, just like a kid would be getting oral language.
Well, you write in the book that something like 20 to 25% of people that get the cochlear implant, it just doesn't really work out.
15 to 20%
just doesn't really work out for them.
What's happening is that it's not perfect and it doesn't work for everyone, but more and more people are doing better with it, and there are fewer and fewer outliers, you know, who are really not successful. But there is still this variability, and it's frustrating to the experts, because you have some kids who, by all rights, ought to succeed and don't necessarily. And so they're really trying to figure some of that out. And in fact, they think that even the time before, it could just be a few months now in a baby's life, because now kids are getting implants before they're one. And they're getting them on both sides simultaneously, which was not what was happening in the past. But that they're thinking that even a few months without changes something in the processing time in the brain, and that maybe the working memory and the reaction time has something to do with what happens later. But it is important to say that I talked to a lot of researchers, and that on average, most kids are doing better with a cochlear implant, they think, than they would without. This is true.
But there is a controversy about the cochlear implant, and you also investigated the, you know, capital D deaf community, went to Gallaudet College. And for some people, they don't see deafness as a disability necessarily, obviously relying on sign language. But it's a very personal decision. And as a parent, I think parents have the right to make these kinds of decisions. But nonetheless,
I agree 100%. I think parents absolutely should make this decision. It's a decision about outcomes and about it's kind of a choice of environment to some extent too. And so what I do think is important, though, is that people have the right information on both sides. And one of the problems is that you have people on both sides of this issue who have maybe People cherry pick the research that they like, and then they leave out the research that they don't. So, you know, there's really wonderful examples of strong sign language background helping kids to succeed academically. But it's also true that you'll hear from some very ardent deaf culture advocates that cochlear implants don't work, and that's really just not true for the majority.
And why do you think this is such an issue of deep, not just passion, but also disagreement?
I really wanted to understand that. That was one of my goals in this, is because, as I said, it wasn't that hard for me to decide to do this for my child. But what was hard was reconciling my view of what seemed like pretty terrific technology with the view of people saying the same thing was terrible. And so, you know, cochlear implants came along at a moment in, well, for children, they were approved by the FDA in 1990 in this country. And they were, it was just as the deaf civil rights movement had kind of flowered and come to fruition. And there was a lot of pride and respect, a new respect for ASL and American Sign Language is the core. It's the central fact of deaf culture. They consider themselves a language minority, a linguistic minority. And so implants were just another in a long line of attempted fixes for something that they thought didn't need to be fixed and that it was offensive to try. And so I spent a lot of time looking at the history, and I get it. I agree. They were treated terribly. And deaf education through a lot of the 20th century, when people were sent to residential schools and forced to try to speak, to be oral, even without a technology like cochlear implants, and a lot of them couldn't get benefit from hearing aids, I think that's cruel and unusual. And tying people's hands behind their backs so they couldn't sign, it's just awful. And I can really see where that bitterness would come from. And so that helped me a lot to understand how something I thought was sort of miraculous could seem so menacing. I don't necessarily agree still, but I have much deeper understanding, I think, and respect and sympathy. And it's a very rich and vibrant culture.
Indeed. And I don't know whether if you have deaf parents, if deaf parents are more likely to be critical or even negative or suspicious about cochlear implants. Did you find
that? What I understand is that it's a bit of a generational divide now. So people maybe over 45 in deaf culture are still pretty opposed. And I've had some pretty angry comments online. Yeah, I expected that. But it does seem like it's more of a minority now. But that I know that there are more people under 40 who are, you know, people who are having children now, even deaf parents, are in fact getting cochlear implants. Not everybody, of course, but more than used to happen. I think there's less of a sense of automatically being a traitor. And I met people at Gallaudet University who use cochlear implants. And so it's still only about 7-10% of the campus, but there are some administrators and faculty and their students. So I think the goal now is to find other ways of being deaf and to say that having a cochlear implant doesn't automatically have to take you out of deaf culture. And that, I think, is a terrific idea.
I mean, you can do American Sign Language and
or do both. So the idea is a bilingual, bicultural approach where people would become fluent in both languages, which I think is a wonderful idea. Pragmatically speaking, it can still be difficult to pull off, but I think it's a great idea.
And I know of hearing parents who teach their children American Sign Language. I mean, as their
children they teach baby sign language, which isn't necessarily always the same thing. But it's a more constrained, I guess. There is the thought that this is. That this is a language that can, and more and more people are using it as a second language in high school and college as well. So there's more sign language in this country than there ever has been, which is great. But it's important to say that, you know, to be fluent, you really do have to work at it. I've tried hard, and it's difficult. I'm finding it difficult, but, you know, I'm in my 40s. It's not coming so easily.
Let me reintroduce you. That's Lydia Denworth, our guest in this hour of Radio Time. She's written a new book. It's called I Can Hear You Whisper, and it's subtitled An Intimate Journey Through the Science of Sound and Language. She is a science writer, and it's in part about what we've been talking about, also about her son, Alex, who has a profound hearing loss and also has a cochlear implant. I'm Marty Moscowain, and you're listening to Radio Times here on WHYY. Let me get, looks like Terry from Doylestown to join us. Terry calling us up right when the show began. Go ahead, you're on the air, Terry.
Good morning, ladies. Hi, Lydia.
Hi.
In the late 1980s, I was a student. I was studying to be a sign language interpreter in Boston. And at the time, there were two urban legends circulating. One was that a middle-aged woman received a cochlear implant and then went mad because she could now hear herself swallow. Mm. And that constant swallowing sound drove her insane. And the second urban fable, which I just remembered very similarly, middle-aged couple, both deaf. One of them received the cochlear implant and then divorced and abandoned the spouse who still remained completely deaf. And these were, you know, stories that we whispered behind our cubicles and that clients of the social service agency would come in and speak about with great anxiety. And there was definitely a big hostility toward the cochlear implant in the late 1980s. And these are two really terrific stories that perfectly exemplify what you were discussing.
Well, Terry,
have you heard of either of those?
Yeah, no, I appreciate the call to Radio Times, and but she's talking about, you know, a couple of decades ago, and it sounds like that was whether those fables were true or not.
I've never heard those particular stories, so I can't speak to that. I think it is true that what happened is people get these ideas, and then even today I hear people saying things that really aren't right. I've heard people say that it's brain surgery, for instance, which it isn't. In fact, it's in the temporal, mastoid bone out near the ear. Right. I also think that adults who've been deaf their whole lives have the hardest time using a cochlear implant and benefiting. So I'd be kind of surprised if someone could hear us so well
that they could hear themselves swallow.
But you never know. People get environmental sounds kind of, but that usually means, you know, that now they can hear the fire truck coming down the road. And that is because the amount of time that you're deaf changes your brain. And so that's actually a good thing if you're going to be a signing person, because the parts of the brain that are auditory then start to get used for other things, for some visual things. And that's adaptive. But if you want that sound to come in and get used in the way that we're talking about to acquire language, then you need not to let too much time pass.
Terry, I appreciate the call to Radio Times. And what we're talking about is a device that's kind of fitted in the ear. And then there's a thingy.
It's called a coil, right? It looks like a big hearing aid, really. And then there's a cable that goes up. The thing that distinguishes it from a hearing aid is that there's a cable that travels up. It sort of sits just to the northwest of the ear, a few inches above and behind. And there's a magnet in a coil, in a little round plastic thing about the size of a silver dollar, maybe. And the magnet on the outside and a magnet on the inside. And then there are electrodes from the magnet on the inside that travel right down, and they weave through the inner ear that looks like a snail. And then they send that signal to the auditory nerve, which is what your ear is doing when I'm talking to you now. It's actually is transforming acoustic energy into electrical energy ultimately at that same place. But as I said before, this is just making it electrical a lot earlier. And it's sending the signal, radio transmitting it through the skin between those magnets.
Amazing. So when Alex takes his implant off,
He's deaf, so he
can't hear anything.
He has a little bit of hearing in the other ear, less and less over time, because he has continued to get hit in the head. He's an athlete. He's a boy. A two-second digression, but the day that the doctor called to say that they had figured this out, and here's the recommendation, no karate, no scuba diving, and I'm frantically writing this down. Alex is two. And I turn around, and all three of my boys are jumping off the couch.
Of course.
Karate and scuba diving are not going to be my problem, and that was true. But he's a big athlete. He loves to play. He's a good athlete. And we have ended up letting him now. The hearing in that left ear has gotten worse and worse. So that means that when all of his equipment is off, he really can't hear us.
Well, let's take another short break. Okay. We'll get back to our conversation again. Lydia Denworth is our guest on Radio Time. She's a science writer. In fact, she has written for Scientific American Mind, Parents, the New York Times, the Wall Street Journal, Newsweek, Red Book, many other publications. And we're talking about her new book called I Can Hear You Whisper. It's about the science of sound and language, the plasticity of the brain. And it's also about her third son, Alex, who when he was two was diagnosed with profound hearing loss. 1-888-477-9499. We'll be right back.
Hello, I'm Russell Kaufman, president of the Wistar Institute, a proud supporter of WHYY. For over 100 years, Wistar scientists have helped keep your families, friends, and employees healthy because of our research that guides the creation of early-stage drugs. We then work with the pharmaceutical industry for their final production. Our name may not be on these cancer drugs, but our fingerprints are all over them. To learn more about how Wistar keeps you healthy and our region economically strong, online at wistar.org.
This is Terry Gross. Often when I'm interviewing people on Fresh Air, they give me a different way of looking at the world.
We all thought our bike was cold in the rain, that our fish was lonely in a fishbowl, that a leaf would be afraid of heights when it fell. It's just the way we looked at things.
Join us for new ways of looking at things on Fresh Air.
This afternoon at 3 and again tonight at 7 here on WHYY 91 FM.
The Philadelphia Foundation supports WHYY. The Philadelphia Foundation helps make nonprofits stronger, offering workshops and services designed to increase effectiveness and build the capacity of organizations throughout southeastern Pennsylvania. The Philadelphia Foundation can help you support the organizations you care about today and forever while you receive tax deductions. The Philadelphia Foundation, 215-563-6417 or online at philafound.org.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen talking with Lydia Denworth. When her third son, Alex, was about 2 years old, he was diagnosed with profound hearing loss. And as a science writer, she dove headfirst into learning everything she could about hearing in order to help her son navigate the world of sound. And in her new book, which we have been talking about, I Can Hear You Whisper, she takes readers through a journey into the deaf culture, cutting-edge science, and the challenges that she has faced, and the joys, it sounds like, as well, raising a child with hearing loss. And we have calls coming in at 1-888-477-9499. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. And you can send us a tweet at Marty Moss Cohen. Let me get Doug from Downingtown to join our conversation. Doug, go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi, good morning.
Good morning.
Hi, Lydia. Your story is almost identical to ours, actually.
I get that.
My oldest son's 5 years old and has bilateral cochlear implants.
Okay.
And he was actually diagnosed a couple months after he was born, only because the hearing machine was actually broken on his birthday.
Oh, wow.
And so I began to notice that he wouldn't respond to sounds like pots banging, the dog barking, along mm-hmm. those lines. So we eventually got the test, found out he was deaf, went the hearing aid routes, which I think everyone does anyway, mm-hmm. and they didn't do anything other than supposedly stimulate the hearing nerve. So we decided to go with the cochlear implants, which I had never heard of, but my wife had, mm-hmm. and then got them put in a week after his first birthday. And they told us at the time that, you know, about by the age of 3, he should be completely caught up on speech. We're thinking, well, that's great. Wonderful. So he gets it. We're moving along. We're getting services about once a week from the state. And not much progress is being made. Mm. So we start considering what are our options. And then I start looking things up online. And I found that there was a school in Northeast Philadelphia mm-hmm. that actually catered to children with hearing aids and cochlear implants as a Catholic school. So we thought, well, we'll probably move up here by the time he hits kindergarten. Go ahead and send him there, because we were living in Charlotte at the time. And my wife actually found a school in Bryn Mawr called the Clark School, which actually mm-hmm. caters to children who have hearing aids and cochlear implants and works on their spoken language. So we relocated up actually for that school, and the progress he made there has been phenomenal.
That's
actually
great.
Actually mainstream next year. The problem that I found, and maybe you've kind of across this, is there's not a whole lot of information to parents about these kinds of schools, because, you know, the language that they speak there is focused for kids with this kind of hearing loss. And
well, you know, Doug, yeah, let me take, first of all, I really appreciate you calling mm-hmm. in, and I'm glad that you found the school that's right for your child, and I want to give our guest chance to respond, because this education issue is so important.
That's critical, and yes, you're exactly right, Doug, and I'm glad Alex actually went to the Clark School in New York. They there are several campuses around the East Coast. And it is a wonderful thing. But you're right. And that's actually a big part of the book, is the point that these kids need language, and they need extra language. And every kid, they need language just right from day one, and they need it all the time. They need it explicitly. They need a different kind of instruction. They need things repeated, and which is actually the case for a lot of kids with special needs too, and reading issues and things like that. That's what I'm finding, that sometimes what's required is similar, but there really aren't. I do feel that exactly as Doug said, that you think, okay, we've got this, now we're good, and that is unfortunately not Right. And, yeah. you know, you still, like I said before, that's when the real work begins. So it's great, especially in those preschool years, if kids can get into programs that are specially designed for them. And then, as my son did, he was ready for the mainstream, as it sounds like their son is too. And he has done terrifically well in the mainstream, but still with support. So I sometimes have to argue in New York City, where we live, for the services that, you know, they say, well, but he's doing so well. I say, right. But he's deaf. He needs constant attention. And, you know, you cannot assume. And so early on, it's the language. But then later, it's paying attention, looking for gaps. And the language only gets more complicated and sophisticated as kids get older and school gets more complicated.
Well, and one of the, and sort of the other side of this is that for a number of people who are deaf or mm-hmm. have deafness, many of them just don't have that kind of progress in school. In fact, something like the median reading level, something like fourth grade median.
Historically, the mean reading level for deaf adults over the age of 18 is fourth grade, which is terrible. And it's now deafness itself is not the problem, because there are deaf people who are only signing and who read fabulously well.
Sure.
It's often because they got language early. It might have been visual language, and they got and they had, you know, educated parents who and they got good education, and they so the critical thing is the language early. But as I have been saying all along, and as the book makes clear, sound really gives you a boost, because it gives you this access to phonological awareness, which is the fundamental skill you need to be able to read. And people think, oh, you need to make the connection between sounds and letters. But in fact, before that, there's this earlier step that has nothing to do with letters and everything to do with sound. It's the breaking up of speech into syllables and phonemes, the smallest piece of sound. And if a kid can't do that, then they're not going to get where they need to go. And so even parents of hearing kids need to understand what that is. I'm sure they hear it in the schools. People use that term all the time, but I'm not sure that I even knew what it really meant until I had to pay such close attention.
Doug, I appreciate the call to Radio Times. Let me see what Alexandra from Quakertown has to say. Alexandra, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hello. Thank you, Marty. I have a boy who is 7 years now, and he was born severely deaf. He doesn't have any mm-hmm. hearing. So he has bilateral cochlear implants now, mm-hmm. and he is actually doing beautifully.
Great. That's great.
He actually is trilingual and American Sign Language is not one of those.
That's great. So more the better. Mm-hmm. Yeah, go ahead,
Alex.
I'm
most interested, talking about school, by this age we understand that actually we need to teach him self-advocacy.
Yes.
He needs to be able to speak up for what he needs.
Yes.
Which professionals who work with him do this job beautifully. He was actually mainstream even in preschool. He was able to do that. My question is, right now, he knows, of course, that he is deaf, but he is in a state that sometimes he doesn't believe it.
Huh.
He doesn't see any difference between him and normal hearing children. So what I was wondering, looks like Alex is mainstream too.
Yes.
I'm wondering, how does he identify himself? How does it play into his social interaction with other kids, and whether it actually changed with age?
Alexander, it's a great question. Go ahead.
Thank you for that. I'm so glad to hear that your son is doing well. I think you're about to hit it. 7 to 9 is an age where a lot of kids start to wrestle with identity and start to see the differences. My son, like yours, is able to function awfully well. He operates, as they say, fluently in the hearing world. He has a lot of friends who treat him quite normally, I think. Still, though, you know, there's a difference. This is where I'm adopting a lot of the ideas of deaf culture, and I'm trying to teach him that the difference doesn't have to be a bad thing. It's just who he is. It's part of who he is. I'm not going to lie. He's had times of being quite upset and saying,
upset that he can't hear.
Upset that he can't hear. He doesn't want to be different. He doesn't want to be deaf. He doesn't want to be different. My own sense is that that is probably a process that everybody has to go through at some point, that, you know, you see the differences, and then you have to and you're absolutely right, Alexandra, that the teaching them to self-advocate is important. But then when they get to middle school and high school, it like runs exactly counter to where they are developmentally, because they don't want to stand out. They don't want to have to go tell the teacher that they need something different from what everyone else wants. So I'm sorry to say, you have some difficulty ahead. But on the other hand, he identifies as deaf now, and I think that's been great. And in fact, this book, you know, I wasn't sure how he was going to feel. I mean, it ends when he's about 6-7 on purpose, because then it's as much my story as his mother, I think, as it is his. And I'm sharing things from when he was younger and he doesn't even remember. I think it's harder, and I try more carefully. I'm more careful about what I say about how he feels today. But he's done a little bit of publicity, just to, and he has really, it's been lovely to hear what he has to say and to let him have a little ownership of it.
Alexandra, I appreciate the call to Radio Times and picking up on what you just said. I'm looking at a piece that was in the New York Times about you and Alex, and the person who was interviewing you, Catherine Booten, said, "I asked him, Alex, what bothered him most about hearing loss, and he said, when someone says, never mind."
Yes.
And she said, you know, same, I guess she has...
She's deaf too.
She's deaf too, and she says, "I know exactly what you're talking about." I guess...
It's the number one complaint.
And the complaint, why?
Well, because it's when people, it's too irritating for the hearing people to have to catch you up. And so they say, "Oh, don't worry, never mind, you know, it's not important." But of course, Alex feels, "Well, it was important because you said it. Don't leave me out. I do not want to be left out." And I gather that that was interesting, because so Catherine lost her hearing, the reporter for the New York Times lost her hearing as an adult. She was struck by the similarities of her experience with a kid who has essentially been deaf from birth, and that, you know, their experience of the world is in many ways quite similar.
Again, Alexandra, thanks for the call to Radio Times. You can call as well. And again, that phone number, 1-888-477-9499. Or you can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. Or you can send us a tweet at Marty Moss Cohen. And I'm talking with Lydia Denworth, author of a new book called I Can Hear You Whisper, and you're listening to Radio Times here on WHYY. Let me get, looks like Eva from Ambler to join our conversation. Eva, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hi, Marty.
Hi.
And Lydia, I've been listening. I have a deaf daughter who became deaf from meningitis in 1993.
Wow.
And so she was 20 months old. And so she was one of the first people to receive, she was the youngest child to receive an implant at that time.
Wow.
And but it didn't work out. And so we've had a whole different life because of that. And she had to have the implant removed because you can't do an MRI with an implant in there.
Right.
So she had other issues, and you need to have them taken out. So that's all fine, but she's had a totally different life, and she goes to school, and she's doing wonderfully.
Oh, that's great.
What I wanted to say is that now there's sort of this bias, because so many people do so well with cochlear implants, that it's kind of a thing, except, of course, if you're a Gallaudet, but it's kind of a thing where people are like, "You're deaf. Why didn't you fix it?" So I just, you know, sometimes it doesn't work, and there has to be a recognition that it doesn't work for everybody, and you know, sign language is good for everybody, and the technology that we have nowadays, she texts with everybody, she's included with everything. It works out, but
you raised some really good points, including the fact that something that we touched on earlier about this sort of controversy and a bit of finger pointing when it comes to this issue. Let me give Lydia a chance to respond.
No, Eva. I really appreciate you calling in, Eva, and you're absolutely right. And we did talk about this a little bit earlier, that it does not work for everyone, nor is it something that everyone chooses. I think more people are choosing it now. But you know, there is still this it's important. This is part of why deaf culture is so important. But other things happen too. The technology changed for email and texting, and then the Americans with Disabilities Act also changed the landscape a lot. And all of those things are critical, and they need to stay, and they need, and they do need. And I can imagine that you are in a kind of a funny position, and I sympathize with that. And it's important that you know that I always say they work, but not perfectly and not for everyone. That is, and I really mean it when I say that. I have met many children for whom it doesn't work.
Eva, I appreciate the call to Radio Times. Let me shift gears slightly. You had a piece in Bloomberg News a couple of months ago about veterans coming back from our wars in Iraq and Afghanistan, and many of them experiencing hearing loss, tinnitus, you know, various sound-related injuries, really.
Yes, they're calling it a silent epidemic in the military. And I think, I'm forgetting, you have it in front of you. I think it's four, they're four times more likely, I think, and when you're under 40. And a lot of people, you know, really don't recognize going into the service that losing their hearing is a very probable end result. And I think we need to be doing a lot better by these people.
In fact, I think as of last year, 414,000 veterans of Iraq and Afghanistan had experienced service-related hearing loss and tinnitus. I mean,
that's an enormous number.
Half a million.
It's an enormous number. Exactly. I was stunned. I went to a conference and we had a Marine Brigadier General, I think it was, speaking about this, and this was just not something that was necessarily on my radar screen, but I now, as soon as I wrote about it, and I've heard from a lot of people, in fact, my father was a fighter pilot in the Navy,
oh, really?
And he too had some hearing loss, and so I think there are a lot of people out there who relate to that, and the problem is there's a kind of macho tendency in the military to say that, you know, we're fine, or it's a sign that you did something important and you were close to the action. And so that doesn't help people address the issue.
We're almost out of time here, but it's interesting to be talking about something that is silent,
yes.
You know, whether it's an epidemic or problem.
Yes.
Because of we're talking about sound and for some people, the inability to hear it.
Yes, indeed. No, that's very true.
Well, on that note, Lydia Denworth, thank you very much for joining us today on Radio Times.
Thank you, Marty, so much for having me.
You're very welcome. Great for us as well. And again, the book is called I Can Hear You Whisper, and it's subtitled An Intimate Journey Through the Science of Sound and Language. And our guest is a science writer. In fact, she's written for a number of publications, including Scientific American Mind, Parents, The New York Times, The Wall Street Journal, Newsweek, Red Book. She also wrote a book called Toxic Truth, A Scientist, A Doctor, and the Battle Over Lead. Go to WHYY.org/Radio Times, and you can find out much more about this program, including Facebook, Twitter, podcasts, email archives, and Sirius Satellite Radio. Kevin Griffin, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times, the show produced by Susan Greenbaum, Patty McMahon, Debbie Builder, and Emily Bryant. I'm Marty Moscoane. Thank you so much for joining us.